Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is University of Florida plant molecular biologist, Dr. Kevin Fulton. We're going to be trying to separate fact from fiction regarding the safety of and need for genetically engineered foods. Our human nature is that we have a tendency to worry about things we don't understand. And there is, I think, some significant misunderstanding about genetically engineered foods that perhaps we can help you understand better today. If you have questions or comments, you can reach us easily. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, you can email us during the program at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Dr. Fulton, it's a pleasure to have you on Line One. Thanks for joining us from Florida.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
In reading through your biography, one of the things that caught my attention is that you you had to do some special work to get into a science fair, I believe, because you were the youngest person in the history of the world to ever want to get into one. You were in kindergarten anyway, and they weren't going to let you in. Is that true?
That's true. At my school, they only allowed science fair once you were in maybe third grade, fourth grade. And knowing that I was going to the school, one thing I was looking forward to was the science fair. And when I heard that there was no, you know, students weren't allowed in, for kindergartners especially, I didn't take that terribly well. And I eventually ended up working my way into it.
You know, it brings to my mind another kind of peripheral comment about this. I know when I was going through school, I was an athlete. I was playing football, baseball, soccer. The school didn't mean much to me. I actually went through to a lot of college, even. It was still true. And then I developed some significant interest in science later. And I have a feeling that a lot of what we do in this country in school actually turns off some people to science because we think of science as doing all these chemistry experiments and so forth, when to me it's more important to realize how we think scientifically and try to answer questions. To me, looking at it that way, if I was educated that way, I think I'd be more interested in science. It's just a great big bunch of mysteries that need to be solved using this way of thinking. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I do. I do think that's true. I don't remember who made the quotation, but there was something about we're born curious and have it beaten out of us. And I think there's a natural inquiry, especially with the natural world, mm-hmm. and that people are very interested in the world around them and the things that creep and crawl and the plants that grow outside and why the weather changes. And we have all these natural curiosities, but as we get into school and as we're maybe exposed to science as a more dry and rote exercise rather than a tool to unravel good questions, that's where we kind of lose our interest. And I think that science education going forward will really try to bring in much more of that discovery feeling. I think that's how we'll turn that ship around.
Okay. Were your parents or other family members into science early, or this just happened on you without that kind of mentoring?
Well, I think my father is, whether he's not really a scientist by his business card, but mm-hmm. he is very much a scientist in the way that he approaches the questions of his business. Mm-hmm. And he's a communications engineer, works with two-way radio. But from the very early time of my life, I remember watching, and I'm only 43, but I remember watching the Apollo moon landings and, you know, sitting there and watching the time tick away on the screen where this thing was getting ready to take off. And I remember asking questions about, Mr. Rogers once said, you're bigger than the water. And I had to ask, well, what is the fundamental unit of water? And we talked about atoms. Mm-hmm. And my dad showed me that, he said, there's more atoms in the tip of this pen than in, you know. So he just went on and on about teaching me about science early. And so that's where I think I got it from.
Mm-hmm. And it is also true, I think, that business in general, the well-done how to plan the future, how to run a business, kind of evolved a lot along the scientific way of thinking in the 20th century. And many, many, many businessmen now who run big businesses are using tremendous amounts of evidence and data and statistics to make decisions.
Yes, absolutely. When you consider that that the scientific method works, mm-hmm. it allows us to separate or to test our idea, test our hypothesis and determine whether it does or does not hold validity, mm-hmm. and whether there's evidence that supports it or does not support it. And currently in business, there's very few things that proceed off the drawing board without a substantial foundation of surveys and tests that scientifically evaluate a question or a trajectory to determine whether or not it will be profitable for the company. In many cases, companies can actually produce new products or new ideas that never really existed except in theory on the computer and were validated by statistical models and by testing with consumers. So in that way, we've lost the model of build it and test it, rather, you know, test it with consumers, to a model where we come up with an idea and test it almost in silico and get people's ideas, people's feedback, and then come up with the optimal product.
Along the same line, a downside perhaps of business is the need to sell their product and promote points of view that may not be completely accurate, and to support others who may go out and try to promote their idea also. So what I'm getting at is, just in a measure of being honest and unbiased, when we get to talking about genetically engineered or modified foods, are you personally getting any research money, any support from any of the big agricultural companies?
No, as much as I'm accused of this, no, I'm not. Our funding comes strictly from federal sources, such as National Science Foundation, USDA, and some small support, which is wonderful, from industry, but all local farmers' industries, this kind of thing, growers' industry, growers' groups, not any of the large agribusinesses at all.
Okay. All right. So what do we mean by genetically engineered and or genetically modified foods?
Yeah, this is a really important distinction to make right up front, because for over 10,000, maybe even almost 20,000 years, people have been genetically modifying plants. This happened when someone was the hunters and gatherers were out looking for food, finding plants that seemed to have substantial characteristics that may have been superior to other plants in the same area, and maybe would save those seeds from those superior varieties or superior lines, and plant them the next year when they start to actually develop farming techniques. And the idea of selection and taking the best ones from every generation really is genetic modification. You're changing the total genetic makeup of that plant and sequestering certain genes in that one genetic background. As time went on, there was a tendency to begin to start to develop crosses, where taking plants from different environments, maybe different geographical regions, nature does this perfectly fine as well, taking plants from very different environments that never would have crossed naturally, that come together to produce a superior product. Strawberries are a wonderful example. I work with strawberries, so I know this one off the top of my head, but what the colonists brought back to Europe in the 1500s, and then a French spy brought back strawberries from South America in the 1700s, and together they hybridized in a garden, mixing 45,000 genes in crazy ways that could have never been predicted to make a superior outcome. So this idea of genetic modification has been going on for a long time, just through traditional breeding, and by natural crossing, and by unnatural crossing, of course, traditional breeding and selection. What is typically thought of as genetic modification in the usual parlance is this idea of scientist-assisted single gene transfer from via a laboratory. So a gene coming from one plant or one organism, maybe bacteria, maybe whatever, coming from that organism and being moved into a plant where all the cells of that new plant now contain this gene and the traits that it confers. So for the purposes of today's discussion, we really should focus on that second definition, where it's this single or maybe small suite of genes that are shuttled by a scientist in a laboratory to form a new plant that contains that gene.
Or perhaps endow that new plant with more superior properties, more useful properties?
Well, typically, that's the goal, is okay. At least in terms of its commercialization, that we know a lot from plants and plant biology and plant molecular biology, where we can take any number of genes. Their typical plant contains between 30,000 and 45,000 genes, where most of them we don't know what they do. And genetic modification or genetic engineering allows us to test in a plant what that gene might do. And so most of these are never destined for commercialization, never destined for anything more than scientific testing and validation about what that gene actually does. Once we find out that there might be a possibility of conferring some sort of positive trait or positive ability to the plant, then it can be shuttled in and move towards commercialization, which is a very, very rare instance, absolutely.
So that latter diagnosis or definition, that latter use of genetic engineering is I think maybe misunderstood, if I'm hearing you and thinking about what I hear people talk about, misunderstood is that moving genes from one species to another is really a useful tool with which to understand how genes work in plants, not to make new plants at this particular time. The idea may be eventually, but that's not where things are really at, with except for rare exceptions, is what I heard you say.
No, I think that's accurate. That 99.999% of genetically modified plants that are made, these new plants that contain this single gene, are never escape the laboratory, never leave the laboratory. They're made just so we can understand what a gene does. Mm-hmm. And that allows us to have a better textbook and also allows us to say, once we know that this gene or this gene variant contributes to a trait of interest, now we can go look for natural variants of that gene. We can go out into wild populations. At least now we have a target that we could use to incorporate genes through traditional breeding because we used a GMO step as an intermediate. Mm-hmm. And people don't have so much of an aversion to that because it never is showing up on their grocery store shelf directly.
Mm-hmm. I guess I have to use the term Frankenfoods to keep people interested that are listening and they're going to want to use it. And I'm going to use an example that I got in an email, which involves fish, not plants. But there are apparently efforts being made to make fish much bigger by implanting genes that will make the fish bigger. So that seems to me at the commercial front there. And so that, I think, does bother people specifically. Can you talk about that, or is there a reasonable analogy back into other plant-based foods that are important for us to help us understand that?
Well, the example that you're speaking of is this genetic, just genetically modified salmon, which can grow extremely quickly because of the introduction of a growth hormone gene from another fish. And it allows the fry of this fish to take on tremendous weight and body mass in a shorter period of time, which in the circles of fish rearing and feeding people with farm-raised fish gives substantial advantage because you can invest the same amount of material and get a much larger outcome sooner. It takes away the possibility of a window of loss due to other outside factors or disease. You just have this larger fish faster. I think that kind of example is a really good one because, and I know, by the way, I do really like the term Frankenfood. I think it's perfect. And I hope at the end we have time I can tell you why. Because I just adore the term Frankenfood. And what was really set to be a term of derision really turns out to be a quite accurate moniker for the discipline. There are a number of similar ideas in plants. So if you could somehow make a larger fruit, or certainly that would be of interest. But really the big questions in fruit and in vegetable modification are, how do you keep things free from disease? How do you keep plants that will grow the same yields or more greater yields with less environmental input? And how do you make plants which will be rendered safer for workers and safer for consumers? And these are all targets for genetic modification or GMO science.
Let me remind our listeners that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is genetically engineered foods. My guest is Dr. Kevin Folta, a plant molecular biologist from the University of Florida. He's joining us by telephone from from Gainesville, I guess.
Yeah, sunny Gainesville, Florida. Ooh.
And so if you've got questions or comments about the safety of these products or how they're made or how they're anticipated being used, don't hesitate to give us a call. Let me give you some local numbers, 550-8433, 550-8433, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E at kska.org during the next hour or so. Quickly, I guess I'd also like to bring in the name Norman Borlaug. And I ran into his name several years ago doing this program, and I think it helps focus on why there is, knowing about Norman helps us understand and focus on why there is a need to be more efficient in the foods that we make. And do you want to comment on Dr. Borlaug and what he accomplished?
Sure. Dr. Borlaug, he's one of the people who really should be a household name, but isn't. And it's amazing how many people, usually when I'm giving a talk about this topic, I'll ask how many people have heard of Norman Borlaug. And once in a while, a hand goes up. And it's pretty amazing that, someone with his credentials and with his accomplishments is relatively unknown. He did win the 1970 Nobel Peace Prize for his contributions to agriculture and for feeding people. Essentially, he grew up on a farm and went to college in forestry, and after that worked for DuPont and U.S. Army, coming up with novel products for the military. And his big step came when he started working in Mexico for the Cooperative Wheat Research and Production Program. And during this time, he realized that it put him in a country that was developing. He was around people that were starving. And he came up with really innovative strategies that traditional agronomy said would never work. Ideas such as double cropping, maybe crossing really remotely related plants to try to develop new hybrids that would contain traits that would give resistance, or some of the best were wheat dwarfing types that crossing dwarf wheat with regular wheat would result in smaller plants that would lodge less and produce more. Basically, the big accomplishment of all of this is what we think of as the Green Revolution, what happened in the early 60s, where places like Mexico or India, Pakistan, maybe were growing X amount of wheat per year, but after a very short time, within 20 years, were up fivefold in the amount of material they were producing. It turned Mexico into an exporter of wheat, tremendous advantages. The back of the envelope calculation is that over 1 billion people are alive today because of Norman Borlaug.
So, yeah, the way I look at, or one of the things I think it's important to understand is that, and then we put up on our website a graph of the growth of the human population in the world, and you notice since it's been, we can estimate it, it's just exponentially in the last 300 years, and without the ability to become more efficient in growing plants and or food and protecting them from pests and making them more productive and using our land more efficiently, we couldn't have done that. And so I think of him as really a lifesaver by some of the techniques that he came by, and I think that's why he won the Nobel Prize.
Literally a lifesaver, and someone who would forever change the way that we pursue the ideas of breeding and the ideas of the disciplines that are involved in the invention of new plants. People don't think of plant breeding and generating new plant lines as a very sexy or interesting thing or an area of interest, but the idea of plant invention, coming up with the next greatest variety that can feed more people with less input and safer for the environment and safer for workers. These are huge objectives of the plant breeding industry, in industry and in universities. And Norman Borlaug's fundamental contributions are at the core of shaping our current activities.
All right. We have a call. I want to take Mary's call right now. Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thank you. I have a question. The answer that your guest made was a little bit not misleading, but I don't think it was superly definite. On these frankenfish, do we get a bigger fish faster for the same amount of food input as a smaller fish, or do we empty the ocean more quickly of the uneconomical food fish for the frankenfish?
Okay, so I'll tell you right now, I'm not an expert in this particular area. I've only gone through what I've read on this. But from what I understand, this is in a farm, primarily these are geared for farm scenarios. And the idea would be to take a amount of food on fish farms, which typically is pelleted, as far as I know, and using this same amount of food to get the fish bigger faster. I'm not aware of any idea of releasing these.
Do we input the same number of calories for the same amount of ounces on the fish, no matter what the size of the fish is? Or do we get more of the resultant fish for less input of food to that fish?
Ah, okay.
Okay, my understanding is that it's the same amount of input to get you to that same end state. It only happens faster.
I don't think thermodynamics will allow us to make bigger fish without more energy.
Okay, in that case, I'm dubious of the frankenfish. I don't need a bigger cow, fish, whatever, faster for the same amount of input.
Okay, but maybe you don't. But
we're emptying the oceans.
No, I don't.
These are all farm
fish that nobody else wants to eat, but other fish need them to eat. And when we take them all away, presto changeo.
Well,
here's a question maybe for you: if you could raise more fish in an artificial environment, like on a fish farm, that I could raise them faster and with the same amount of input, and have fish therefore more readily available for the consumer, could it possibly be true that you would impinge on the ocean's limited resources less?
Probably not. Something has to go into the pellets. Do you see where I'm going?
Well, you have
to make the pellets out of something. You don't just say, God, please hand me pellets, and it happens. Somebody is taking something and turning it into pellets.
Well, the pellets could be...
And the likelihood is perhaps fish waste. I know here in Anchorage...
No, it could be corn.
In the Mad Valley, the salmon waste is now turned into vegetables that's on the organic farms.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the bottom line is, I mean, if we really need less people to feed, if you really want to get down to that, I guess.
Well, I have a very naughty and subversive solution for that. Just insert something else into the pellet.
All right.
I'm wicked.
Soylent Green.
But no, I just wondered. You can't. Get then for the same amount of calories, you get the same number of ounces of fish at the other end. Yeah. You just get it bigger, faster.
I think so.
Yeah, that's my take on the technology.
Yep.
Okay, well, I can do with a smaller fish.
All right, thanks for your call, Mary.
Thank you.
All right. What are some concerns that the academics, the government, the people that are regulating these things have that we need to really make sure we touch base on?
Well, the major concerns from an academic or government regulatory environment really are that the products are completely safe and tested within reason, that any of the potential or at least plausible outcomes have been evaluated, and that really does help us a lot with GMO food, because we understand exactly what the gene is, we know what it does, we can trace it, we can track it, we can understand its physiological manifestations. This, when we go back to just traditional breeding and we're crossing 45,000 genes at a time, we don't know what can possibly happen, and it's much more random and much more haphazard than the surgical precision of GMO foods. Plants make plenty of toxins on their own, and as evidenced, and these have been removed from our cultivated varieties through cultivation or through selection, And how easy would it be to bring back something? I think that the major concerns are that is that things are safe because people are dubious of the technology and concerned about the technology. We do have a general overlaying feeling among scientists anyway that the technology is tremendously safe and has tremendous promise, but still must be going forward very safely.
Kiddo. We're going to take a short break. I want to remind our listeners, if you'd like to give us a call and ask questions or make comments, our local number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails and talk with University of Florida plant molecular biologist Dr. Kevin Folta on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about genetically modified and genetically engineered foods. We've discussed the definitions and some differences between those two terms, and we're discussing this with Dr. Kevin Folta. Dr. Folta is a molecular plant biologist at the University of Florida, and he's been very active in helping the public improve their understanding of science and how science works. Dr. Folta, again, welcome to Line 1. We appreciate your taking the time with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be able to spend the time with you here.
Since we've just talked about some of the concerns, and there's environmental and human risks is a big area. We put on our website a link to a Penn and Teller comment on modified foods, and in that, which by the way is not probably appropriate for everyone to listen to. Penn and Teller make some great points, but they may use some words you may not want everyone to hear, but it's worthwhile listening because in the middle of that, there is an interview with, and I don't remember which organization the person was with, saying that there is no regulation of this research and these products. And I also have a link on the website to a guide to all the regulations. You want to comment on the regulations?
Yes, the regulation is stringent and occurs at many different levels. It occurs at the level of USDA and APHIS, which is their central agency for handling animal and plant health. It's also GM foods are regulated by two other agencies, the EPA, to make sure that there are minimal, if any, environmental impacts and to ascertain what level those impacts occur, and also the Food and Drug Administration, which has to validate food safety for human consumption. The regulatory process is so extreme and so difficult and costly to navigate that it really is a bottleneck for implementation of GM technology, especially for, say, guys like me, university research scientists that have ideas, maybe products in their lab that could have tremendous benefit. When you look at who is actually releasing GM varieties, it's the big agribusinesses because they have the opportunity and they have the expertise and the lawyers and the money to navigate that mess of regulatory hurdles. The people who really disapprove of big agribusiness and who really don't like the fact that GM crops are owned and run by these big companies, they should be voting to decrease the regulation because by decreasing regulation, you would actually be allowing smaller businesses to compete in this area. You'd be allowing academics, university researchers who maybe have other ideas, and we're not profit-driven per se, to be in these areas, to put crops in these areas. Ideas like the GM papaya is actually came from USDA, and a USDA researcher, and rescued an entire industry. There's a plum variety which can be used as a rootstock for other stone fruits like peaches, apricots, which has been developed by a USDA researcher and shows tremendous promise of stopping plum pox virus, which is a devastating disease to stone fruits. So these technologies do exist, and they do come from people out there in a university or in a government setting, but it's very rare because the regulatory hurdles are so many.
Have there been well-described, well-researched, well-reported evidence of problems that we need to know about? I guess what I'm getting at is, in a sense, is this idea that something's being hidden from the public. I mean, this has been going on for a while. There's been some research. Are there some problems lurking that we should know about?
Well, it goes into that. It plays into that conspiracy mentality, and that there's something that we're just not learning about, or the scientists are keeping this down. You know, if I, in my studies and in our research, we found any evidence that there was something harmful that came from a gene that we were studying, or a result of manipulating a gene's expression. And I were to report that, it would be on the cover of Science and Nature. I would have grants forever and would probably get a Nobel Prize. The fact of the matter is that people are looking hard for evidence of harm, and they don't find it. That occasionally there are reports in the literature that say that there's toxicity to cells, or damage to cells. And these reports typically come out of in non-impact journals, smaller studies in non-impact journals that really aren't expanded on or replicated. And they're typically studies that are performed in a petri dish. So you have cells in a petri dish, you add maybe powder from GM corn, and they don't do well. But that's not to say if you put in regular corn, they would do the same thing. Now, they're poorly designed studies that are seldom replicated. Yet, when they do have some sort of conclusion like this, the media runs with it because it sells papers. And you can read a number of places online about how kidney and organ failure comes about because of Monsanto products, just because there was some data point that came from a petri dish.
Mm-hmm. And I guess from a medical standpoint, I think it's important to realize there are kidney failures that happen from aflatoxins and things that are normally present in mushrooms and so forth. So you have to put things in perspective as well.
And that's a good point, because a good point with the aflatoxins is that GM foods, or GM corn at least, that does not have is not subjected to pests, like the BT corn, which makes its own herbicide basically, does not have as many burrowing pests that are moving into the corn. And these areas where burrowing are typically ingress for a number of fungal species which produce these toxins. So the corn that is protected tends to not harbor as much of these mycotoxins as conventional corn or organic corn. So, in fact, it's even healthier than for people.
Let me remind our listeners once again, if you've got questions or comments today about genetically engineered, genetically modified food, safety and appropriateness of use, give us a call. Our local number here in Anchorage is 550-8433, 550-8433, and a toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us during the program at line1@kska.org. You mentioned BT corn, and I hadn't put that on any of my questions or problem list. That's certainly a name that gets a lot of attention, or you read about now. What do we mean by BT corn? What are the concerns that you read about? What's the reality of BT corn?
Well, BT corn, BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, and Bacillus thuringiensis is a naturally occurring soil bacterium that produces a small protein that inhibits the digestive capacities of caterpillars or certain lepidopterans. And the reason that it works is it causes a change in the structure of the gut of the caterpillar. The BT toxin is produced as a long protein that is cleaved specifically to its toxic form by an enzyme present only in the gut of the caterpillar. So it has no toxicity outside of this to non-target organisms, to humans, anything else. So BT toxin, and BT toxin itself is used in organic culture because it's a naturally occurring compound that kills pests. So BT has been approved for a long time. What science has done is actually created corn plants and also cotton and others that actually synthesize the BT peptides. So rather than having to put this thing on, the corn makes it itself. And when an organism starts to feed on the corn, it dies. So in this way, it slows colonization of pests in a field of BT-resistant corn and limits the amount of crop loss that farmers endure because of insect predation, and also gives the consumer a better quality product.
Does it affect accompanying fields? It seems like I read something somewhere where there's some benefit outside of the immediate zone of where these are being used, too.
Yes, the recent study actually was in Science, actually a note in Science, that indicated that there were positive benefits that were conferred to conventional farms and organic farms adjacent to the transgenic because of lower colonization and lower presence of these pests. So it had the ability to actually protect the non-transgenic. The same thing was observed with papaya, where countries that did not allow the transgenic papaya in would get their same papayas from the adjacent field because they'd actually plant the non-transgenics in a circle, in the center of a circle of transgenics to protect it from the virus that was spreading amongst non-protected papayas. So the presence of the GE does actually confer a level of protection to the non-GE crops that tend to surround them.
Okay. I have a couple of callers. I want to take one right now. Herman, you're on line one.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. My question is, you know, the Supreme Court came down with a case some time ago that basically gave corporations the ability to patent, like, seeds. How has that impacted the diversity in our food source and our supply, and number one, and because of the corporate, second question, because they have this ability, I think it's been demonstrated that they've limited people's ability to reseed, to seed their own product with different seeds because they own the seeds themselves. And does that also have an impact on the diversity of our food supply?
Okay, that's both very good questions. The way in which it affects so first of all, if you want to decrease, and let's just talk about diversity in terms of the natural flora and fauna of an area, which is a little bit of a departure from your question, but the thing you do is you build a farm. You're adding plants which were never intended to be there naturally, and you're decreasing the diversity of that area. In terms of the diversity in our diet, the fact that there are only a very few number of companies that are producing a small line of plants that farmers absolutely love and they grow them, does decrease the diversity in terms of the actual substances or the actual products that we can obtain with those organisms, with those cultivars. But that's been happening for decades already in a non-GE way. Certainly, farmers have always purchased the most productive, high-yielding varieties that work best in their environment, those that they were most familiar with and could cultivate and get the highest quality product. So that's been something that isn't just a question of GE. It just is happening in a much smaller area now than it used to. The other question was about farmers' ability to reseed. And this has come about because when entering into a contract with one of these big agro firms, farmers are contractually bound to not bag seed and maintain it for following years. And this rubs people really wrong because they think, farmers should be able to collect the seed and use it the next year. And when we think about it a little bit deeper, this has been happening since the early part of the 20th century with the introduction of hybrids. Farmers had one elite line and another, and a second elite line, or I'm sorry, corporations or plant seed companies had two very elite lines, perhaps, each which had outstanding characters, and were able to put those two together and then the next year sell the hybrid seed. Simple genetics dictates that if that hybrid crosses with itself, the progeny will not necessarily resemble the parents. So in other words, companies have been always selling hybrid seed as a way to protect their interests as a company. They sell the hybrid knowing that the farmer is less likely to brown bag their own seed because the next generation won't be nearly as productive as the hybrid. So it was a way that these companies have always had to kind of ensure future sales was by using this hybrid technology. And no one really objected to that. In fact, we benefited greatly from this. Probably three times the production after, almost immediately after the introduction of hybrids. So this idea now is just the same idea.
If I could just do a quick follow-up question. You know, when I was taking biology classes in college and stuff, I've always taught that, you know, biodiversity is a very important to our ecosystem. And so what is the long-term consequence then of having such a monopolistic control over the seeds that we're utilizing for our food supply?
Well, I think that the question of biodiversity is important. And this isn't necessarily a GM question. This is a farming question. Mm-hmm. How do we feed people with more food, with less environmental impact, and still be able to maintain diverse environments of plants and the populations of organisms that are beneficial and pests that live around them? And I think as we go forward, we're starting to see more of a, as they do this with GM technology, that you have to have forage areas and sanctuary areas for insects that are beneficials or other organisms, that places where they can live and thrive. And if you think about it, and this is particularly true going back to that BT question, if you have a plant producing a pesticide that can target a specific pest, and you're not flying over that biplane that's dumping out tons of insecticide and killing every single thing that crawls in the field, you're seeing an effect of how transgenic technology and this Frankenfood technology is actually tremendously beneficial to maintaining the biodiversity of these areas.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Herman. Dave, you're on line one.
Yeah, thanks. Without having a lot of detail here, it seems to me recently I've been reading numerous articles about how they are farmers in the Midwest are having problems with the spread of the GMO crops, their seeds and stuff, to their fields, even along the fence lines and stuff, and they're being prevented from harvesting their own crops. In fact, they're even being sued by Monsanto for Monsanto's crops blowing on the wind. And I'm simplifying this and not getting it all right, but basically, that it sounds like, as I read, there are a bunch of farmers that are very ticked off that they're suffering severe financial consequences because these GMO crops and their seeds cannot be confined and stopped, and they are paying a price for this spreading. I just wonder what you hear about that, and if you can give me any accurate information. I realize what side of the fence you're on, but it would seem to me that this is a legitimate problem. Thanks. I'll take my answer off the line. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks for your call.
Sure. No, thank you. And the side of the fence that I'm on is just the side of the fence that has the evidence on it. I mean, I go where the story goes. And I've heard about this before, and I understand the concern. And really what's happening, this particular instance has been really blown out of proportion with this information. People talk about the seed police and the Monsanto Gestapo and, et cetera, et cetera. But essentially what has happened is you do have pollen drift that occurs naturally, and it moves into these other fields. It moves into adjacent fields. That happens. And Monsanto itself, when you go down and look through the reality of this, has not prosecuted many people for this at all. The people that they have prosecuted and the people where they've won have been people who have been using their seed illegally, especially Roundup Ready soybeans, and that they were actually found to be using their crop illegally, that they didn't just get it from pollen drift, and that those were the judgments that were actually found. It would be a really bad PR move to start going after farmers who were using non-GE technologies, because they're the people that they would most likely like to convert to GE technology going forward. So it is a subject that comes up frequently. Certainly the pollen does spread and can be found in these other areas and tested for. There's no doubt about that. But whether or not this is the authenticity of those claims is, especially like the best case is Percy Schmeiser, was one who was well documented. It's very, very thin evidence that they're doing this to just sue every single farmer based upon a few plants on the edge of a field.
I've had an email and a question before the program to me about how does an individual know if they are buying, eating, in one way or the other, getting genetically modified foods? Is there a regulatory effort on labeling these in grocery stores and restaurants and so forth? And then I guess the sub-question is this really important at this point?
Yeah, you see, I'm kind of bittersweet on this one, because I think we should have full information about what we're eating and where it's from. I love the idea that we have country of origin on labels. I think it's really important, and it's great for us to be able to support local farmers if we can have the ability to select their produce based upon labeling. That said, there's such an irrational movement against GE food that they have refrained from labeling it as such, and you really don't know if what you're getting is GE or not, unless you're buying something that comes from certified organic, which does not, at this time anyway, permit GE or transgenic technologies. Chances are, if you're eating soy, corn, canola, if you're wearing cotton, you're coming in contact with genetically modified food or GE Frankenfood, which again I think is a very useful term. That's a really important note to take, because this stuff is consumed so widely by humans and other animals without any evidence of any harm. So it's really important to keep that in mind. In the future, I think maybe we'll see a move towards labeling. I don't know how I feel about that, because I just think there's so much irrational fear built around this subject that it really would be detrimental to food production.
How about, as a general rule, the nutritional value over time of genetically modified foods? Is that monitored? Is it better? Is it worse? Is there potential, loss of nutritional value over time to an individual if they eat a lot of these genetically modified foods, let's say over the next 10 to 15 years or so?
Well, there's no evidence that there's harm to humans or any particular effects on humans that have been reproducible or documented in any meaningful way. Certainly, we know that there are genetically modified versions of corn, higher protein feeds, other types of modifications that are being used with cattle, and certainly it allows farmers to produce bigger cattle faster on the same amount of feed. So in that regard, we're seeing, again, benefits of the technology.
I want to make one comment about another potential benefit being worked on out there. I do a lot of allergy work in my business, and peanut allergy is a very, very common problem, and there's a lot of approaches being taken to that. But one is genetically modifying the peanut, and as my understanding, and Dr. Folti, you need to correct me if I'm wrong, is there's efforts being made to identify the gene that makes the protein that most people react to, and if we could hybridize or make that gene remove and still keep it as tasty, as long-lasting, and as otherwise good, we could control peanut allergy in that mechanism. Are you aware of those efforts, and have I stated something incorrectly?
No, you're right on the right track. That especially with now that we're sequencing genomes at the rate of one per week, plant genomes are coming out faster and faster. And with the genetic description of the parts list of a plant, you can make very good predictions about proteins which are potentially allergenic. And these are very conspicuous with very known patterns. And once you understand what those proteins are, you can then go ahead and use this kind of G technology to suppress their expression. And the idea of a peanut where allergenicity has been removed, or any food allergies have been removed, these are certainly realistic and probably very, very reasonably close technologies.
All right, we've got one more caller. I want to take Terry. Terry, you're on line one. And let me remind both you and Dr. Folta, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. So let's see what you got. What your question is.
Okay, well, I've got three quick points. First of all, I think there might be a logical fallacy happening here in that not having evidence of harm does not equal having evidence of harmlessness. I believe the fact is that there's no data on the long-term health effects of GMOs on people because GMOs simply haven't been around for that long. And it seems to me that the experiments are actually being run in the field on people, on the public, which I feel is unethical because I know that I, for one, was never given my consent, which, you know, there are standards for this.
Hold on. Speaking of logical fallacies, you can never prove that. You know, we don't know that the sun's going to come up tomorrow. You cannot use that kind of logic reasonably. We don't know that the food you're eating today or yesterday or 50 years ago is going to be safe. The immunizations I got for polio 50 years ago, we don't know because no one's lived longer than me. I was one of the first people. So that is the worst kind of logical fallacy, Terry.
You and that is why I question people using it, because your guest keeps saying, well, we don't have any evidence of harm. I'm just pointing out that just because we don't have evidence of harm doesn't mean we know.
Right.
I'm just agreeing with you that you have it's just as scientifically unrigorous. But I'm wondering if you're aware of the animal studies that are cited in places such as Jeffrey Smith's book, Genetic Roulette, and other places, that these animal studies, because they can actually test over, you know, entire lifetimes, have revealed quite a few deleterious effects. And then also on the BT, what's happening is that organic farmers use BT as a very last-ditch effort. They try to use it very sparingly because, of course, if the pest builds up resistance, then it becomes useless. And so they're quite concerned that by using BT genetically, there's going to be a higher likelihood that pests will develop genetic resistance, and therefore the organic farmers won't be able to use it. So could you speak to those two points?
Okay, so the main point, so let's start with the BT. The mechanism that BT uses really suggests that it's not easy to develop resistance to this because it involves several different steps and is very specific to this organism. It's very unlikely that there would be a selective ability to circumvent the BT toxin. It could happen, sure, but is it of greater benefit to fly over planes that are dumping tons of insecticides and endangering workers and leaving residues on food? To me, that's much more of a risk than the plant producing its own toxin and a potential, well, maybe this might happen. The other question that you brought up was with regard to Jeff Smith's ideas that there are animal problems or documentation of harm in animals. Jeff Smith is a classic example of somebody where the work is very well cherry-picked and doesn't have a lot of real strong scientific backing. If it did, it would be on the cover of Science and Nature, not buried in the anti-biotech gazette. If these things are real, if what he describes is true, it would be in much higher venues and would be studied by scientists everywhere all over the world. And it just isn't.
Okay, well, it would be great if we could have more long-term studies that weren't done just out in the field because, again, we don't really know what the answers are for a whole human life on this issue.
Well, I agree, we also don't know what's the ramification of taking vitamins every day for 40 years. What are the ramifications of eating hybrid food, just hybrid corn that is grown organically? What is the risk of eating organic food? You know, no one's done that study, so we shouldn't eat it. You know, I can't subscribe to that kind of thinking.
But using a virus to penetrate cell walls with completely different genes is above and beyond that, and definitely way beyond the natural hybridization that farmers have been doing.
You're what we call, in the logical fallacy thing, moving the goalposts now. And we appreciate your call.
Well, in viral transposition and movement of introgression of viral sequences or jumping genes, transposons inside of cells, viral introduction, you can find viral sequences in any single plant genome which have come in naturally and have changed the way genes are expressed. So it's happening all the time.
I'm interested in the science, so thank you for that. And I don't appreciate being dismissed just because I have questions about the science. Thank you.
So your point, Dr. Folta, is that probably ever since there's been life on Earth with viruses, is that genes have been being transferred by those viruses into plants and animals. And so that's not new either.
No, and by bacteria. And these are mechanisms that have been in existence forever. And I really wasn't dismissing your caller. I'm glad that she has concerns, and I'm glad she thinks about these things. I just encourage her to continue to be even more rigorous about her pursuit of real answers that are scientifically validated. And that's what's really important.
I think perhaps she was more upset at me because I get frustrated as well. We need to always look at the risk-benefit ratio, and we know that millions and millions and maybe billions of people are alive today because of some of the efforts that are being made. We don't know of any really well-described problems, and it's not that they're not being looked for and trying to be found. Go ahead.
That's a really important point, because if we strangle a technology because we don't understand it, then it doesn't do good for anybody. And that's why I really like the term Frankenfoods. Frankenstein was made in a laboratory by people, and or Frankenstein's monster. And when it escaped the laboratory and went out into the public was frightened by it, mostly because they didn't understand it. And they destroyed it, not because it meant harm, but because they didn't understand what it was. And in that regard, Frankenfoods is a really appropriate term, because many of the townspeople of the day are really upset about the technology and don't even want to see it used, even though it could have tremendous benefit for people worldwide.
Okay. Well, really, you want to leave any final, just last thoughts to kind of wrap up the bottom line here?
Well, I think what's important is that people differentiate between the science of genetic modification of food and the potential of that, and separate that from the socioeconomic side, that when it's used the way that companies are using it and the way that it's being profited from. I think it's most important to keep in mind that this is really important technology that, if used appropriately, could have tremendous benefits for everybody.
Thanks very much for taking the time with us, Dr. Folta of the University of Florida. And next week we'll return with the University of Louisiana psychologist Dr. Brian Bramstead to discuss about myths in popular psychology. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI Media and News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Thanks for listening, and especially to those of you who took the time to call and email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.